This is our next installment of our substance abuse discussions. And tonight we have Dan Bowman and Michael Rasnick will be speaking with us. And then after that, we will have a short time of question-answer discussion. They're going to look at substance abuse issues from a law enforcement and legal perspectives, and they will say much more about that than I will. This is an issue that has affected most everybody in our neighborhood, and we find that not only are there technical aspects of what medications or drugs might do, but most of the issue seems to be our attitude and people looking for relief in one way or another, and finding that use of substances usually just doesn't work out well. But I'll quit talking now, and I think Dan's going to talk with us first.
Appreciate y'all coming out and being with us this evening. We're going to begin our discussion in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 4. The perspective that I'll bring to this platform and to these discussions that we've had is from a law enforcement perspective. I've been in law enforcement state level 29 years as of the third day of January. I was enlisted in the war on drugs back some time ago. I've known from personal experience, from property crimes, crimes of violence, that the attachment, the presence of controlled substances in these events is very domineering. It's very present. Sometimes you look at the motivational factors associated with why people commit some of these crimes, and there's a controlled substance in the background. Our society today has minimized some of the impacts. We know good and well that there are souls at stake. Our society has minimized the impact of controlled substances as we pursue other paths, seeking legalization and reduced sentencing and things of those nature, and much like the children of Israel, leaving the good guidance and good patterns that were set by our fathers in some instances. So society has decided that maybe there's not as big an issue with some of these as there once were. Because that minimization is present, I'll be pretty frank tonight. It's my intention to be phenomenally clear. And it's because of the risk. That's my intentions. It's not because I'm not concerned about these souls, or I'm not concerned about these individuals or these families that are impacted by this. But it is my intention to be very frank. So with that, let's look at Romans chapter 13. Verses 1 through 4, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. Verse 4, for he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Substance abusers who gain access to pharmaceuticals disobey the law when they create an environment that we've been discussing called diversion. Under the notion of a prescription, an assessment is made and professionals trained in that area write a prescription based on their assessment to meet an assessed need. When that formality is not present, my name's not on that cylinder, I'm using that controlled substance, I've created what is called diversion. That is illegal. Romans chapter 13, 1 through 4. Obey the government. Not only is it a federal violation, 21 U.S. Code, it's also a violation of Title 39, Chapter 17, State of Tennessee. Substance abusers who gain access to illegal controlled substances create crime merely because they are in possession. So it's not just the pharmaceuticals. It's crystallized methamphetamine, hydrochloride. It's cocaine that varies in its percentage value of weight of cocaine hydrochloride. It's the level we should be concerned of tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, particularly THC-9, I guess, in controlled substances related to marijuana. Those are the things that we probably should be concerned. I'm going to try to look at this briefly from three perspectives: users, dealers, and victims. In 1989, I was being trained along with some other guys by a drug enforcement agent, and he was very much old school and had been around the block. And what he taught us was the cycle of dependency, and it's a graph, and I could use what he used to teach us, but it's very easily visualized. You simply list the spiritual needs, which would be in our application, the top three. Then you list the physical needs of life, the top three. I would say that's water, food, and shelter. And then you list the top emotional needs of life: emotion, belonging, security, love, your list. And then as you start this cycle of dependency, you start erasing those. And so things that were important in a religious perspective go out the window as a very pure form of cocaine, nicknamed crack because of the noise it makes when it's heated, takes over. So the emotional needs and the support system that a family provides is second place now to a controlled substance addiction. So if an individual that is riding this cycle of dependency has money for product or money for rent, where will the money be spent? I think you know that. And I've been very fortunate to be in some fairly advanced law enforcement trainings over the years, including the FBI's National Academy. And I was very fortunate to get to attend the National Academy of the FBI. But what that DEA agent taught me in 1989, and it took him less than an hour to do it, I've never left. It's so simplistic to understand how these folks are replaced in a substance abuser's life because of product. The individuals involved in controlled substances, as we're studying in our prison ministries class downstairs, create a phenomenal tax liability, a tax liability for the taxpayers. They're also involved in several other types of crimes, the users are. I'm going to be very frank with you, and I was working interstate detail in Sullivan County. It was always a matter of time until we would have a robbery at a convenience market during the interstate. And there might be a 7-Eleven, it might be another chain of market. But we called them stop and robs. One case in particular, an individual pulled off the interstate and conducted a robbery and used no mask. And his license plate was very visual. And needless to say, we were able to stop him in just a short period of time. Product was a little bit more important to him at the time than getting caught for armed robbery. So when we see these phenomenal risks that these people take, broad daylight crimes, property crimes, especially home-type crimes — this is East Tennessee — breaking into homes and in people's private property presents its own risk in this area. And we have those that do that. There's probably substance abuse behind that. Those are very poor decisions. The dealers. The unspoken motto of a drug dealer is pretty plain. One man's loss is another man's gain. It's exploitation. Whether they illegally write prescriptions or conduct drug transactions on a street corner, The unspoken philosophy is realized in the decisions that they make and their priorities, which is money. Money is the only motivator to become involved in this. The first character trait that I noticed in dealing with those that were consistently peddling controlled substance was a vein of laziness that would never go away. It was seen as osmotic. This was the path of least resistance to money, to nice automobiles and SUVs and jewelry and the like. So that work ethic was not present. We didn't see it. Second character trait I noticed was self-centered. Interviews, 95% of the interview sentences begin with the pronoun I. 95% of the interview was buy into my rationalization. It makes sense to me. Everybody's doing it. It'll be legal one day anyway. The U.S. Sentencing Commission has revised sentencing guidelines and has decided that this type of sentencing structure is wrong, and those individuals that are doing what's called minimum mandatory sentences in federal penitentiary need additional and due considerations. As a matter of fact, they should be released in some instances. And that's exactly what happened a few years back. And we're on the path again of another cycle of destructive drug abuse. We do the same things, it seems, over and over and expect a different result. How can that be? And of course, another character trait is greed. Drug dealers empower violence through user addiction. They fund those who wish to destroy us through a concept called narco-terrorism. So this crosses international boundaries and borders. At one time, we did not call NAFTA NAFTA. We called it NAFDA, the North American Free Drug Agreement. And the decision to basically frame an interstate that would go from the Mexican border to the Canadian border, we kind of called it a drug freeway. It's interesting how those political decisions seem to have an impact. Let's talk about the dealer's impact for just a minute. I went to the Bureau of Justice Statistics to pull some statistics. Fiscal year 1998-2012, 84% increase in incarceration rates, 84% increase in incarceration rates. Is that a failure of the home? Or is that a failure of society? Is that a failure of the church? Or like some of those tests in high school, is that D, all the above? Isn't that terrible? Phenomenal incarceration rates. And I think we could probably say that the annual cost of that as a minimum is $25,000, probably more, minimum. Who's paying for that? It's very interesting when you consider that, isn't it? Who's paying for that? The Master Settlement Agreement in the South primarily was a lawsuit that validated that sometimes the manufacturers of tobacco maybe change their ingredients in their recipes to breed addiction. And because of that, more people had upper respiratory issues, lung issues, COPD. Therefore, the tobacco companies, through what's called the Master Settlement Agreement, will be required to pay huge amounts of cash to these states to offset primarily indigent medical cost. We don't see that in the drug market. 63% increase in individuals incarcerated during that time frame that are doing time for drug-related offense. 52% of inmates, federal inmates, are drug offenders. And sometimes our society seems to think if we legalize drugs, that problem will go away. If you take the rattles off the snake, you just don't get a warning. That's how that works. One aspect of this that I want you to consider, and I don't want to be offensive, but those who are very professionally involved in the criminal trade are politically active. In some instances, their goal is not legislation that brings legalization, because that can bring competition, legitimate competition to the workplace. One of the targets seems to be to use influence to reduce the punishment or to reduce the sanctions. In Tennessee right now, there is a bill that is moving along the process to become law, and this same bill was presented last year and it was defeated, that would change the way drug dealers' assets are subject to forfeiture in the state of Tennessee. I don't know if you've ever seen a vehicle that law enforcement uses that says seized from a drug dealer. This process that's being proposed would be much different, and it would bring sanctions on law enforcement if there was not an agreement in the, I guess, the court community that this was a just and this was a procedurally correct seizure. So the supporters have brought their comments to the plate that say law enforcement officers are looking for opportunities for seizure so that they can bring money into their departments. And that is the argument that they're using. I will tell you that the legalization in Colorado projected sales tax were not realized. The governor of Colorado missed his sales tax projections his first year by 46%. But you notice that the legislation did not go away. Commercial growers were ready. When that legislation passed, pot Walmarts sprung up overnight, and indoor grows became common in the state of Colorado. That's a real interesting study that we don't have time to discuss here tonight. But you know, the weatherman has to be right more than that to maintain his job. I want to talk to you for just a few minutes, and then I'll be quiet, about the impact that this is having on families. Is there anyone seated here tonight that's not been touched by this in one way or another? Family member, friend, tragedy. Those of us that have got a couple of miles on the trail, if you could go back to your high school annual right now, could you see the names of substance abusers then and match them to a obituary that you've read over the past 3 or 4 years and wonder if that fascination with controlled substances, that appetite that was developed in high school that was never suppressed, finally culminated? Because like that DEA agent said in 1989, he said, boys, don't forget this. The cycle of dependency ends in death. They may beat it for 25 years, but they'll only beat it when they're gone. Hopefully they'll be clean until then, but they'll struggle, and they will struggle. If you've never been in this situation, you can't possibly identify with it. It's a phenomenal physical and emotional pull. The impact on the family, I want to focus on the at-risk member of the family who's experimenting with controlled substances. The first thing that the family members are going to do, particularly the parents, is they're going to react. And the reason you're going to react probably very emotionally is that finding out that your child is experimenting with controlled substances should scare us to death as parents. And you should respond to that. And the response should be very plain, because that child's soul is at stake. So the at-risk family member starts consuming all the attention, especially of mom and dad. The at-risk family member seems to be a focal part of the family's income as court costs, juvenile probation, restitution, and this destructive path is realized. So as the child is conducting the be on a roll and doing what is expected, then that child merely is overlooked, because the at-risk child is at risk, and that needs more of mom's attention, and that needs more of dad's attention, because that's a life or death situation. brothers and sisters may feel neglected as the family income and attention and support is all directed to one family member. Victims of drug-related crimes, we've already alluded to this, property crimes, accidents, crimes of violence. And then the really hard part, the addict themselves. The addict themselves sitting at a red light, sitting at an intersection, awaiting benevolence from some kind soul, oftentimes so they can continue their own path of destruction through the empowerment of love for a human being from a fellow man. 1 Corinthians 3. Beginning in verse 16. Know ye not that ye are the temple of God, and the Spirit of God dwelleth in you? Verse 17. If any man defile the temple of God, him shall God destroy, for the temple of God is holy, which temple ye are. Verse 18. Let no man deceive himself. If any man among you seemeth to be wise in this world, let him become a fool, that he may be wise. Thank you.
Good evening. Oh, that feels better. We start the slides if we could. Let me begin by saying I got a little slide presentation if we can get it going, and then the views expressed in this presentation are strictly my own. Don't necessarily reflect those of the elders here or the district attorney's office. It is a prosecutor's perspective. Up in the upper right corner is the present. I guess there it is, right there. There you go. Okay. And I don't know which one of these. Which one of these, Tim, does the next law? Bottom. The one down? It's Google Slides. There we go. Okay. Dan's already talked about motivation. We'll see what you come up with as motivation. I'll take you through what's kind of how we got here and from my perspective and what's going on now around us. I found this article from the Royal Pharmaceutical Society Journal. It's kind of dated. It's from June 2015. If you look at the bold print, it's talk about... there was a time when we, in the 90s, when there was this all came about, there was a focus on pain and dealing with pain. And coinciding with the shift in medical perspective was the introduction and extensive marketing of oxycodone. For the treatment of non-malignant pain, OxyContin sales representatives visited doctors across the United States, leaving them with gifts, free patient samples, invitations, all expenses paid symposia, all actions known to impact prescribing. I just put this slide in here about 5 minutes ago, well, 15 minutes ago before Dan started talking. This is a news article from March 11th today, posted at 11:07 a.m. CNN says, more opioid doctors prescribe, the more money they make. It goes on to talk about how some doctors were paid to travel the country and paid six figures to give speeches around the country on the benefits of opioids. That same article back in the Royal Pharmaceutical Society tells us from 1996 to 2012, global OxyContin sales increased in the U.S. from $48 million to $2.4 billion. Worldwide increase in OxyContin parallels that of other opioids, morphine, codeine, and other things. 1991, 2009, U.S. prescription of opioids increased 300% in Canada, 91 to 2007, 850%. United States has been in the forefront of consumption United States consume 99% of the world's hydrocodone, and that's from 2009 statistics. 60% of the world's hydromorphone, 81% of the world's oxycodone, and if you'll remember, the United States has about 4.4% of the world's population. Look at this is kind of dated, but I like the colorful chart. Back in July 2014, you see these states prescribing the most in the dark there. More prescriptions per person than other states. Again, another slide showing the same thing. Tennessee is the top of the top, and then again, that's from July of 2014. This is a county perspective in 2015, MME per person, and I think that's morphine milligram equivalency, is that what that is? And if you'll notice, the dark spots, again, are the most prescribed, Upper East Tennessee, Southwest Virginia, right there in the middle of it. That's from 2015. See if you can, I got a short little video if we can play that. And hopefully there's sound somewhere. This is from 2011. It's a little dated too, but I wanted to. I'm sorry, anytime you want to do something technical. Think it's gonna feed the sound into it? Well, this is to describe it a little bit, it's an undercover video from 2011. They go to a pain clinic down in Georgia, and the producer goes in and he just says, you know, I'd like to see the doctor. They take his money. And they send him to a specific place for an MRI. That MRI place only takes cash. And then they ask him, do you got any pain? He says, no, I don't really have any pain. You been in a car accident? No, I haven't been in a car accident. And they say, okay, have a seat. You're going to have an MRI. So he has an MRI. The results of the MRI are only given to the doctor of the pain clinic. And as you're seeing there, the tags from that the cars in the clinic are from all over the country, Tennessee, Kentucky, all over. This is out of Georgia, and these people line up, and you can see there's multiple videos, undercover videos of law enforcement taking this, where people, doctors say, don't line up the door, that looks suspicious, and before we open, and so they watch the doctor walk in, the security guard comes out, drops his hands, and people just like rush to the door and start lining up to go in and see the doctor. But anyway, after this one, he gets a prescription for various things, Percocet, hydrocodone, and never sees a doctor at any time during the process. All he has to do is go through these few steps, and he's taken back to the waiting room. And one of the things they show there is the seventh visit is free. And we had a clinic here in Johnson City. My understanding is that one time that they gave the 13th visit free at a Suboxone clinic. So let me ask you, what do you think their motivation is there for their customers? And we can go ahead and skip this slide if maybe I can do it. There's the office worker anyway saying, do you got any pain? She says, no. Do you mind to pause it, and then we'll go on to the next one. Can you go to the next slide, perhaps? Yeah. This billboard you may have seen in the news just a few months ago out of Bristol. my best, Bristol's best Suboxone doctor, most people seen in 30 minutes or less. And it's here in our own backyard. This is Miss Betty, I forgot her name, Betty Jordan, I think it is. This is from, she was arrested last month in Parsons, Tennessee, Decatur County. She is accused of having more than 1,000 pills in her home. She's 75 years old, and she's had hydrocodone, morphine, Xanax. She had $12,000 in cash and other assets in her home. Apparently, they've been watching her for a long time. The reason I put this slide in there is, number one, it shows it affects everybody. It's not just the 20-something gangbangers out there trading drugs. This affects everybody in all aspects of walks of life. And the second reason I put the slide in there is that if you see her escape, you'll know that she's about 4 foot tall, as you see in the booking picture there. So we recognize a woman 4 foot tall. You know, maybe Betty. This is a Washington Post article I found. Counterfeit opioids are now coming onto the scene. When people can't get in to see their doctors, they're clamping down on the doctors, you're seeing more counterfeits come on the scene, and people are buying them off the street. People are making these pills at home, and you don't know what's in those pills. Heroin is becoming more prevalent now because they're clamping down on the doctors so much. In 2011, Border Protection at Los Angeles found two pill presses. In 2017, they found 396 pill presses coming through the borders for people to make counterfeit pills. And they are lacing these pills with fentanyl and other things, and you don't know what you're going to get. The pills on the left are from the TBI confiscation, and the pills on the right are from a case out of Arizona in which they contacted the manufacturer. The manufacturer said these are really close. They look really close, but they're nonetheless counterfeit. Go to that website. Can you go to that website? I wanted to show you a comparison of morphine. Yeah. If we look at the big purple pill up there, it's one unit, or I guess dose, of morphine. And ibuprofen is 1/222 of morphine. Aspirin is 1/360. And acetaminophen, the same thing. You go down to codeine, it's not as strong as a dose of morphine. You go down to hydrocodone, and it's about 1 for 1 for morphine. Oxycodone, about 1.5 times morphine. And then you go to methadone, which is about 3 times the strength of morphine. And heroin is 2 to 5 times, and you're seeing a lot more heroin now coming in because they are clamping down so hard on the doctors now. And Subutex, the Suboxone clinics, is about 40 times more powerful than morphine. You go down to fentanyl, it's 50 to 100 times. And if you go on down to the penny right there, go up to the penny, if you will, the penny, you see a lethal dose of fentanyl compared to that little white spot, compared to what a penny looks like. Fentanyl is what they're putting in drugs now, these counterfeit pills and drugs on the street. And I think they're even putting in, perhaps lacing marijuana and fentanyl. And by the way, marijuana is not the marijuana of the 1970s, 1980s. It's much more potent now and much stronger. You don't know what's in it these days. You don't know what's being laced with. And if you scroll on down, there is what's called carfentanyl. And if you'll keep scrolling till you get to the bottom of that, that's one unit of morphine is equal to 10,000 doses of carfentanyl. Carfentanyl is elephant tranquilizer. They're importing that now and putting it into the drugs that you find on the street. And it is so fine and so powerful. It's about like dust. And so when a police officer or somebody goes in a house and they open a door or they kick a door in, it can make these things airborne. And the officers can breathe them. And the officers are being told, you know, they can't touch any of this stuff and these unknown things. But if you see that visual of that scrolling down through there, how powerful that carfentanil is, 120 micrograms is a lethal dose of carfentanil. Micrograms, not milligrams. If you want to know how much 120 micrograms is, go home and take out 2 grains of salt. A grain of salt is 60 micrograms. 2 grains of salt, you get a lethal dose of carfentanil. And that's what they're putting in drugs these days. And by the way, when you see these pills and the drug dealers that deliver these pills, you want to know how they carry some of those pills and transport some of those pills. Come see me later. It's not appropriate for me to tell you how they do that in this audience. But I'll be glad to do that if you want to talk about it. In Tennessee, as Dan told us, anything Schedule 2, such as meth or the opioids, is called a Class C felony. Carries 3 to 15 years of prison time for a half a gram. And I looked it up. Half a gram's like what? 1/100th of an ounce, something like that, or 1/10th of an ounce. It's something like very, very small. But anything a half a gram or greater could get you 3 to 15 years for opioid sales or possession with intent to sell or delivering it. If you do it, let me back up one. If you do it in a school zone, that can increase you to a B felony. B felony is 8 to 30 years. And anything within 1,000 feet of a school zone is also considered in that zone. You can go on the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation website. I just found out this past week. Put in any address, and they've got it where it'll mark it whether or not you're in a school zone. And it's pretty easy to look up that way. And then you've got, of course, jail and prison as the consequences of possessing or selling. Meth is also Schedule 2. We're basically concentrating on opioids, but meth goes hand in hand. Meth gets you a minimum of 30 days in jail, day for day, for misdemeanor possession, and that could be anything less than even a half gram. Some of the consequences that people may not think about are the fines, the costs, the jail fees. The jail charges you about $30 a day to stay there, and if you've got 30 days you've stayed there for your minimum sentence, that's $900. You're in the hole already. The minimum fine on a Schedule 2 misdemeanor count in Tennessee is $750. That puts you at $1,650 just for the jail fee and the fine. $2,000 minimum fine on a felony possession. And now Tennessee says you got to pay all your fines and costs within 1 year or you lose your driver's license. That's not counting the court costs that go on top of all these things we've talked about so far. And that's not counting if you want to hire an attorney to represent you when you come to court. You go on a felony registry for committing felonies in Tennessee. You go on a drug registry, even for a misdemeanor amount of methamphetamine in Tennessee. We now have an animal abuse registry. We have an elder abuse registry. We have a sex offender registry. We've got the registries in Tennessee, and you can probably guess the employers are out there searching over these before they're considering your application. We can seize your car, as Dan talked about, seize your real property for selling drugs out of your house, for maintaining a house where drugs are used or sold, and that's also a separate D felony as well. They can seize your Louis Vuitton luggage if that's how you transport your drugs or things of that nature. And all these consequences. And when you think that you've got a drug habit and you're out here stealing from Walmart just to support that habit, and then the first little misdemeanor you get, you're in the hole over $2,000, and you've got a year to pay that, or you lose your driver's license, assuming you have a driver's license to start with. And then you go on from there. When worse comes to worse, now there's a concentrated effort for the district attorneys across the state to prosecute homicides if they can trace it back to a drug delivery or drug sale. And these This case just went through the grand jury here recently. It's not as quite as easy as putting the fingerprints on a gun or putting the trajectory of a bullet back to a source. But if we can make that case, there's going to be a concentrated effort in the future. I think Knox County is really trying to push that as well. If they can get it back, somehow trace it back to the dealer, the seller, the person that delivered it, they're going to charge them with homicide anytime there is a death due to an overdose. What does this mean for me? Be vigilant in all that you do, wherever you go, out in public. Keep your cars locked. Keep your purse out of sight. Watch your purse as you've got it in your buggy at Walmart. It's my understanding now that the drugged DUIs have now overtaken alcohol DUIs as far as the numbers go. And so people are out here driving all times of the day or night, and it doesn't have to be a 2 in the morning thing. It can be a 10 o'clock in the morning. I mean, we're seeing a lot more high-speed chases through Johnson City in the middle of broad daylight. High-speed chases going the wrong way down 11E. You just have to be careful and be vigilant and look for those people that are acting weird, acting funny, and watch yourself out there. Guard your medications. If you have some of these medications in your home, guard them like they're gold bricks. Don't let anybody know you have them. Lock and key is the best way to keep them up. Know who comes in and out of your home, be that service personnel, you know, the plumber or people that spray for termites or anything else. Know who's coming in your out of your home, and don't leave this stuff lying around. Had a case out of Fall Branch where a grandmother had her grandson over with his friends, and they had a nice little visit, and then later on they left, and somebody came back to her door with ski masks on, broke in her house, pushed her down, went straight down the hall to her bathroom, to the medicine cabinet, got her medications. How'd they know they were there? They had been in that home, and they had scoped it out, or they'd seen it before. Your identity theft is on the rise. I had a case where a woman got her medication stolen from the pharmacy because apparently somebody standing in line heard her tell her date of birth to the pharmacist. What's it take to get your medication at the pharmacy? My last name and my date of birth will get you my medication. So you got to guard that. Of course, anytime you see any of this, you get involved in it. If you see somebody, if you suspect something, reach out, talk to somebody, and talk to one of us, or we'll try to get you help, and we'll try to point you in the right direction. Certainly, when you delve in down this road, you're going to sow the wind, but you're going to reap the whirlwind. And that's all I had. So I'm not sure if get a moderator now. Or where we go.
I just looked at the time, so that give you some bad news is that we looks like we won't have time for questions at this point. But on April the 8th, second Sunday in April, we're planning to do this again, and the whole time will be devoted to discussion, question and answer. And so if you have particular points you would like discussed or a question about anything that's been discussed or anything on the subject that's not been discussed so far, you can give the question to me or any of the panel members that have spoken during this series, and we will do our best to address those. Again, sorry we don't have time for discussion this evening.
Jeremiah 38, if you'd like to open your Bible with me. Jeremiah 38. As we come to this chapter, this point in the history of Judah, things are pretty much falling apart. The Babylonians have come. They are actively attacking the city now, laying siege. And the king has no power. There are some that are trying to control him. And the attention turns to Jeremiah because he has been prophesying that what you've got to do is surrender to the Babylonians. And, of course, that sounds like treason. So a group of them get together and they say, we've got to get rid of Jeremiah. So we see in Jeremiah 38, verse 6. So they took Jeremiah and cast him into the cistern of Malchiah, the king's son, which was in the court of the guard, letting Jeremiah down by ropes. And there was no water in the cistern, but only mud. And Jeremiah sank in the mud. And you can imagine what that must have been like. A cistern was a place that was, for the most part, sealed. There was an opening, of course, for water to run into. And now you see there is mud, and it's probably fairly deep. And he's sinking, and there is no hope for him if he is left there for any length of time. There's this fellow named Ebed-Melech who hears about what happened to Jeremiah. He is alarmed. He goes to the king and says, we've got to get him out. He's going to die in there. And so we come down to verse 11, Jeremiah 38, verse 11. So Ebed-Melech took the men with him, went to the house of the king to a wardrobe in the storehouse, took from there old rags and worn-out clothes, which he let down to Jeremiah in the cistern by ropes. Then Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian, said to Jeremiah, put the rags and clothes between your armpits and the ropes. Jeremiah did so. Then they drew Jeremiah up with ropes and lifted him out of the cistern, and Jeremiah remained in the court of the guard. They saved his life. Now, the reason I look at this is maybe you have you immediately see the analogy, because those that turn to drugs or substances of any kind, alcohol, they're sinking, and it is a death pit. And they need somebody like Ebed-Melech who will say, we can't let you stay where you are. We need to intervene. We need to get you help. And maybe I'm talking to some tonight who are in that situation. Maybe you're not in very deep yet, but you're in, and you feel that sinking, and you need help. And why are we doing these lessons? Why have we done this these three different months and now another one coming up? Because we care. Because we want to be that Ebed-Melech for you if you are in that situation. There are several, as you have seen, that are, this is what they do for a living, various aspects of it. And they care about you. They would want to help if you'll let them. Or maybe you are that Ebed-Melech and you know somebody who is in it. Again, it may not be that they're up to their neck yet, but that's where it's heading, and worse. But regardless, when we're talking about sin, we're all in it. I was sinking deep in sin, far from the peaceful shore, very deeply stained within, sinking to rise no more. But the master of the sea heard my despairing cry, and from the waters lifted me. Now safe am I. And that's the good news. Christ is ready to pull us out of the muck of sin, the muck that will swallow us unless we turn to him. He can save. If you believe in him with all your heart, ready to turn away from sin, ready to confess him as the Son of God, then tonight make the decision to be buried in him in baptism. That will wash away the sins, lift you out of that sin, and restore you to a place of honor at the Father's side. If you've done that and yet you have wandered back into that sin, come out before it's too late. Come as we stand and sing.